The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami on April 19, 1996 at the Gidanagri Cabin.
Our program says today is a poetry reading. I mentioned yesterday that some of the presentations are more formal philosophy, and some of them are more personal expressions of Krishna consciousness. And I mentioned that that's also, we can see that in among friends, how from beginning to end there's a variety of that. So poetry reading would be on the personal expression side. There's a good definition of poetry, it just came to my mind, I'll bring that up later. So what I'm going to do is read some poems of mine, and in some cases tell some little anecdote that comes to mind about it, maybe how it got written or something that was going on about it, and some instructions and inspirations in Krishna consciousness. But because it's a poetry reading, it's not that I'm going to stop and do heavy preaching or explanation of the poem. That would defeat the purpose of the poem. The poem is a special kind of communication. I was thinking that there are different kinds of presentations of Krishna consciousness and a different cultural medium. And some of them, because of our background and our inclination, we like. And some of them, that presentation is something that we don't like. For example, there's a Krishna conscious rock band. So if somebody just doesn't like that music at all, or the rock musician would say that the person doesn't understand it, then they won't like, even though it's Krishna consciousness, they find it very difficult. And then with similar reasoning, a person who has a background in science will take readily to the presentation of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and someone who not interested in scientific presentation will just think, why all this talk? Let's just hear the Bhagavad Gita. Although there's very important preaching going on by those who take the trouble to present it through the scientific medium. So poetry reading would be like that too. So I wanted to try to say a few things so that it would be more accessible. Of course, no one has such a favorable audience as I have in speaking to you. I think whatever I do, you'll try to like it. But to appreciate poetry, Krishna conscious poetry, when I read each of these little pieces, you shouldn't be just listening to hear what's the philosophy, to extract just the philosophy out of it. Or when it's something personal about me, just to get some autobiographical information about me, as if that was my purpose. So what that special thing is that makes something poetry is hard to define. There's a few little definitions. Someone said genuine poetry can communicate before it is understood. That may be done by just images or the music of words. Like when Prabhupada said, we heard in the tape yesterday about the chanting of Hare Krishna, that you should always chant. Never mind you are in factory. Never mind you are in hell. Never mind you are in skyscraper. Go on always chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So that's poetry. It's not even grammatically correct, but no one who appreciates poetry would want to try to correct the force in which he said it that way. So, it may sound strange to say that philosophy is not the main thing. Krishna conscious Siddhanta is not the main thing. In poetry, the main thing is a certain way of saying it. We take it as axiomatic that we're after Krishna consciousness, and that's being expressed. But if he's attempting to say it in a poem, then it's not just a philosophy per se, but trying to say it in a certain way, maybe with a certain honesty, or with a certain music, or with certain imagery or something that makes it aesthetically pleasing and makes it more forceful, intense, than if he said the philosophy in another way. And as far as autobiography, my use of autobiography, things that I do, things that I think, I use it. It's not an end in itself, but you use it to try to express truths in Krishna consciousness. Someone says poetry is the perfection of a common language. Sometimes poetry can be presented very highfalutin, but poetry has come more and more to be like common speech. But here, as it says, it's the perfection of common speech. It's not just common speech, but common speech with something extra. So it's very personal also, it's very honest. That reminds me of a definition one contemporary poet wrote about what poetry is. See if I can paraphrase it. Said poetry, poetry is the cat concert going on under the window outside of the room where the official history of truth is being written. So the picture is that some professor or somebody is writing, a treatise on what is the truth. And then, I won't explain it. See, when you try to explain something, the poetry goes away. So I think that's enough explanation. First, this is something that was in an old issue of Among Friends, and I read this mainly because of showing you how a poem was born. Not much of a poem. But how it came about. We were in London, Madhu Mangal and I, and there were some other poems about that. Good feelings about being a devotee and being up in the morning. We were staying at his flat, his parents' flat, and we traveled from there to the temple, Soho Street Temple. And there was a poem about that, feeling happy that I wasn't a karmi like the others who were going to work. The last stanza of that poem is, "It was light-hearted traveling through the city in the morning to meet a friend. It's Prabhupada's and Krishna's grace, or I too could be riding to work, casting sullen looks." So then the diary says, the next day I think this was, "In the cab to the airport, the driver plays the radio, Nat King Cole singing, 'There will never be another you.'" And then immediately I wrote these three lines after it. "There may be other Guru Devs, but Prabhupada is true, that there will never ever be another you." So that's just a play on the words of the pop song. But it came about because actually the song moved me, and just that moment of being an American and being in London in a taxi cab, going to the airport, and then hearing an American blues singer sing a song that I knew well, and then partly that whole thrill of being happy in your identity as a devotee, that whatever it is that's going on and you're doing, you're a devotee by Prabhupada's grace, and then turning all that into an expression of gratitude to him. Now I'd like to read some haiku poems, all from one place, from Lessons from the Road, Volume 12, Caribbean Tour. I thought of haiku, although I don't write haiku anymore, because it's the most identifiable poetry that I've written, most identifiable as a poem. It'll be good to introduce us into the feeling of what a poem is. This is a Japanese form. The Japanese wrote it in what was 17 syllables of their language, which doesn't translate into 17 syllables in English. But to be haiku, it has to be almost that short. And something, it should be aesthetically pleasing. And usually there's some turn in it, like something is said, and then there's suddenly a moment or a turn in the poem where something else is said that's not quite logical, but the two things come together. And the way they come together is the way they were perceived by the poet, hopefully not by some clever arrangement to try to make a surprise, but as he actually perceived life, it was with a moment like, oh, aha, something is a revelation. And this is connected also to the Buddhist culture from which it comes. But that they see eternity in just or that they their mystical experience is just to see nature or life and the absolute revealed therein. But the same thing can be applied in Krishna consciousness. We also have our moments of insight and revelation. Although our revelation comes from Shastra and Guru, as we live and practice Krishna consciousness, you have different moments when you see the deity or when you have some exchange with others. So for some years I adapted that form to Krishna consciousness. And let's see some of the results. This is a travel book, so I make a reference in the travel diary to a travel book written by one of the original great haiku poet, Basho. In travel writing, there is a precedent for sharing disappointments on the road. In Basho's A Visit to the Kashima Shrine, the poet tells us that he will make a journey because of an irresistible desire to see the rise of the full moon over the mountains of the Kashima Shrine. Poets of the past had celebrated the moonrise at this spot, and so Basho wanted to join the tradition. I said earlier in this entry that I was getting headaches in Puerto Rico, ISKCON. I couldn't give the lectures, and there was noise during the night. And this is what I hadn't intended to happen on that trip to Puerto Rico. And I probably wouldn't be able to go on Harinam. Then I remembered this concept about when you go on a trip, you meet disappointments. So that's the reality of what actually happens, not what you wanted to happen. So he went on this pilgrimage to see the moon rise, which is a big thing for them in their culture, to gather. Sometimes many people would gather and look at the beautiful full moon rise. But when he went to the Kashima Shrine, he writes, "It started to rain in the afternoon, and in no way could we see the rise of the full moon. Basho stayed up all night waiting, looking to the clouds and listening to the sound of the rain, but the moon didn't show, and therefore he couldn't write any moon-viewing poems." He writes, "It was really regrettable that I had come such a long way only to look at the dark shadow of the moon. but I consoled myself by remembering the famous lady who had returned without composing a single poem from the long walk she had taken to hear a cuckoo. As readers of Basho, we feel satisfied with the reality of his rainy night and with the sharing of his disappointment, and we appreciate the honesty of the man. It was better that he share with us what actually happened at Kashima Shrine. On another occasion, Basho wrote, and here's a haiku by him, "In a way, it was fun not to see Mount Fuji in foggy rain." That means he couldn't see it at all. Okay, so now with a little introduction of what haiku is, here are some that I wrote on the Caribbean tour. This is from a visit in the Santo Domingo temple. "Sunday afternoon, a brahmachari sewing on the sunlit porch. No matter how I lead, the devotees respond with their own melodies." That's based on my continual experience of singing the Sringadev prayer. And I always sing it the way I heard Prabhupada sing it, and the devotees always respond with their own melodies. I sent this to a haiku magazine, and they published it. I thought they probably liked the... that's like real wisdom to them, that you can't lead others, they'll just do what they want to do. And I had to admit, although I was a guru, that it was true. Santo Domingo. There's a devotee here, Garuda Das. It's not the Garuda Das of New York. There's a Garuda Das down there. Disciples meeting. Garuda Das with knife wounds. A woman wearing lipstick. When you agree to write poetry or expose yourself to poetry, especially like this haiku, it's just what is. You don't try to improve on what you actually perceived or what happened or to even preach through it. You take a risk that in Krishna consciousness we want the Siddhanta nailed down, but you don't decide beforehand what it's going to be or speak too much about it. This is very enriching for creative listening, as people, they fill in their own understanding of it, and they take part in it. It's not that you spell everything out. Okay, this is there was a series of haikus. Sometimes you can write one after another on a particular theme or occasion. Some of them are like that in the Caribbean. I'm just reading one of them out of the series. This is during the time when I would stay up all night on Ekadasi. So from that, this is one selection. "Round midnight, singing prayers to the six Goswamis, forgetting all pains." I had a secret pleasure in writing that first line, "Round Midnight," but it's also a reference to a jazz song. Instead of listening to that at midnight, I was doing this other. That now we're in Trinidad. "A cock crows at 3 a.m. in the alley on Nantes Japa." Then this is not a haiku, but I mentioned, you've been to the Longdenville Temple in Trinidad, I guess? Longdenville, the big one. Yeah. So right, you may remember it, right next door, the neighbors there, they play their radio real loud. And it really gets hellish sometimes because it's like direct combat between them and the devotees. And the devotees, they don't make any attempt to play softer, and neither does the neighbor. So they play all this I don't know what the words for it, you know, just pop Trinidad stuff. But on Sundays, they get religious, and they play religious songs. So this is from Sunday, when I was in the room. And so the diary says, this morning while in my room, I heard a combination of Krishna Kirtan and Sweet Jesus tunes, and they sounded quite complimentary. So I wrote it together like that, just as I heard it, actually, I wrote it down. So many people doubt him, I can't live without him, that's why I love him so. He's so real to me. It don't matter what you say, I'm going down on my knees to pray, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Sweet Jesus, sweet Jesus, Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare. Here are some haikus from Guyana. We went to a program to see the mayor, and there was going to be a feast. We will give him some feast prasadam, and a mayor and his cabinet or something. And so we went down there, and before it happened, I wrote these. In the parking lot, bhaktas shaking hands with big men. Big men in quotes. Then another one from there. The mayor has urgent business. We wait 1 hour. The feast getting cool. Then a series called Rainy Season from Guyana, like a monsoon, a hit. A sudden rainstorm pours in the window near the picture of Sad Buddha. Devotee women washing plates in the rain. Downpour. The tied goat tries to pull its foot free. Once again, choosing to lecture about the time of death. There are several temples in Guyana. There's one called Nupanihati. It's way out on the plains, and there's like nothing around. It's a tropical country. It's very quiet out there, no industrial sounds. And while staying there, I wrote this one. Whistling winds, this remote ashram is the abode of the Lord, the Radha Krishna deity. Impressions at Nupanihati. More. When the wind blows, the loose tin roof sounds like it's chanting. I chased a small mouse away from the altar. Twice he returned. Then, I'll change of pace from the haiku. Poetry doesn't only mean this form or that form. Just a way of feeling and thinking. So at the end of that Caribbean tour, I wrote, recalling the Caribbean tour, and I just wrote paragraphs beginning, I remember, I remember, I remember. I'll just read a few of them. I remember that in each Caribbean temple, I woke Lord Jagannath in the morning and bathed him, and sometimes when I looked upon him more clearly, I appreciated his ever-present beauty. But mostly I can't remember where I was and what I did. I remember Govardhan Das in Guyana. I couldn't recognize him at first because he wore a beard. But after a few kirtans, when I realized who he was, I requested through another devotee that he shave. Govardhan replied that he had only throw-away razor blades and they weren't able to cut through his beard. But the next day he appeared with a clean-shaven face. He also wrote me a note saying that he was surprised that even though I was present in Guyana, he couldn't have long, intimate talks with me. From Guyana, I also remember a pot-bellied man who wore a Chant and Be Happy t-shirt. He sometimes joined our kirtans and dancing, and he wrote me a note how he had had headaches for 12 years and cured them by chewing gum. I met a man in Vancouver, and he told me he had headaches for years, he said, and he found a cure, and he wanted to suggest it to me. I said, I know you hear many things, he said, but this was very effective. He said, you just make some chapati dough, put a little milk in it, but basically make some chapati dough and you just put it all over your head. It's amazing. Maybe these things actually work for people. He got rid of his 12 years of headaches by chewing gum. I remember Vrishabhadeva's son. He must be about 11 years old now. When I first started visiting Guyana, he was about 6 years old. He's still very quiet whenever I see him. Doesn't dance in the kirtans, but he waves back when I wave to him. He was wearing a t-shirt with a big colored figure of Mickey Mouse standing shyly with his mouse hands behind his back. Vrishabhadeva's young son is another family member whom you remember when you start remembering everyone. I remember non-devotee faces, the sullen, silent black man who waved the cars onto the ferry to New Amsterdam and who gestured your car into its exact spot. His physique was awesomely powerful, his look menacing, but he did no more than his assigned ferry duties. What about him? He saw the devotees waving happily to me and heard our shouts back and forth, Hare Bol, Hare Krishna, although it didn't seem to move him. I remember the helpers at the new Panihati temple, the lady who works all day washing and cleaning on the dam, the man with the retarded look who hangs around the temple grounds, does little errands, and looks in the temple window. And the temple mice, the mosquitoes, what about them? As Bhakta Eric used to ask, do they get liberated? Lord Chaitanya also asked Haridas Thakur, how will the Yavanas be delivered? I remember Paramatma Das, longtime manager of Krishna's affairs in Guyana, who left his school teacher's job to live in the ashram with sand flies and alligators, who happily told me they have no debts now and are supporting all Guyana temples just by book distribution. His main concern was, will we lose our enthusiasm, as has happened in ISKCON in America? I remember a few old women who have always been in Guyana, ISKCON, ever since I've been coming, who sit and hear the lectures, slapping at mosquitoes, joining the kirtans, cooking, cleaning, and Mother Indira Dasi, faithful widow for Krishna in Trinidad, where she's been doing her, quote, little, unquote, service for 10 years now. And that's that, remembering. And then some travel diary from Trinidad, rigors of travel, going through immigration borders and so on. We entered the immigration area and found ourselves toward the end of long queues. Travelers beware, don't get caught behind a plane full of Guyanese entering into Trinidad. While standing in line, a chubby woman with a short Afro haircut and a red dress began speaking to me. I thought she said, are you Arab? Hare Krishna, I replied. She looked up to the ceiling, laughing as if to say, this guy is impossible. Then I thought she said, Hare Rama. I leaned forward to hear her better while I said, yes, Hare Rama. The man behind her then became helpful. He said, she's asking whether you will carry her rum. She had... She has 4 bottles and you're only allowed 2. No, I said. In our religious order, we don't drink liquor. But you can carry it, she said. Madhu then waved his finger at her with mock admonishment. You shouldn't drink rum either. And we're not going to carry your rum for you. Time dragged on in a land of limbo as the immigration men gave the third degree to each Guyanese. I wondered, does the word rum pass for namabas? That's the haiku. For this reading, I was looking through different, just picking up a book and thinking, when is there anything in here I would read? And it was a nice exercise because out of the whole book, I would just spontaneously think of something that I liked and wasn't necessarily what somebody else might think was the best or was objectively the best. It kind of surprised me, the ones that I remembered. So I'll just take 2 from this book, Talking Freely to My Lords. It was supposed to have the subtitle, but never made it. November at Gita Nagari, and it's like November moods, just after Kartik ends. I have been hearing from devotees in Vrindavan that unless I go there, I can't feel anything. You have to get the mercy directly. The dirt in any room in Vrindavan is conscious, not like the dirt in the West. One grain can fulfill all your desires. But aren't Lalita and Vishakha their most intimate friends? Isn't Radha's smile right here? Can I come to Braja with Damodar? If it's easier for people like me to walk through autumn leaves in boots, if we like to eat prasadam with brown Swiss ghee, and if we feel comfortable here, is that to be held against us? I'll go to India, but I'm just saying, Krishna is here. Maybe one reason I picked this because I was affected by somebody saying they liked it, and it was in my mind. I remember Rabindra Sarup's wife, Sodamini Prabhu, saying she really liked that last stanza. And then this page here, this that Bhakta Rob Head, haven't heard from him in a long time. Very nice artist from New England. And he made a nice picture of the creek at Gita Nagari, which is mentioned in this poem here. And they go the page and the poem. I just remembered a poem a young devotee wrote about 22 years ago. Her name was Himavati, and the poem went like this. The forest is calling to me, but I prefer to stay indoors washing Krishna's dishes. That's the end of her poem. Watching the leaf boats around the bend of Tuscarora Creek, long columns of reflected tree trunks, the wind is up, last leaves fallen, but I prefer to write Prabhupada meditations. So here are some poems from Writing in Gratitude that I picked out. How rare this is, I thought, sniffing the early morning walk. How rare this is, I thought, sniffing the sky air, walking many acres alone. In India, it would not be possible. In Braj, there are always pilgrims walking, no matter what time of night. Radhe, Radhe. That's better than being alone. But this is nice too. Cool air and you're a prince of the early morning walk. Breathe by the ocean, this is called. One time, a store owner in Tucson became enraged and grabbed my danda from my hand. Calling me Kami, he smashed me on the head with it and broke it. I wasn't hurt, except inside. I stopped a policeman and told him. He told me to ride on the back of his motorcycle. Then he dropped me off and said, I'll be back later and you can press charges. Forget it. He never came. I want to go outside now and walk and breathe by the ocean. I'm not bitter, but pleased and very lucky. This is from another section here about India. These are just like what we call slice of life. The way things are, the way you perceive things. And just, if you can write it down with some accurate detail and some honest feeling, then you've got a poem. There's another topic on my mind to bring up during this meeting, and that would be, what is the importance of this poetry, this art, in Krishna consciousness? I'll try to get to that and describe that. I don't want to do it yet because it may sound too righteous, like trying to boost up the importance of the poems. Better to just read them, maybe talk about it more toward the end. But at least I don't think of it as just some entertainment or as a luxury. Delhi kids, small kites, bobbing up above the narrow tenements. Only in the late afternoon, when the heat is down, starved small kites catch air currents. What does it mean? Boys in their summer-style undershirts. No special meaning, just kites. Something to do to waste precious time. Wherever I look, small boys and small, poor kites and air currents. Everyone trying to breathe a little longer, having fun before night. I wrote that on the rooftop apartment or one room that's rented by the devotees. They rent the whole building, actually, temple president. And he has this little room on the top that he lets devotees use when they come through. And that's where I saw this. It's quite a phenomenon. It's like, I don't know, we call it slums of Delhi, but not like the real, I guess you wouldn't say slums. Slums means the bustis, the straw houses. But still, it's very congested. And so all over, it's like everybody's on top of each other, all the other tenements. And everyone is on their roof flying kites. And not like Western kites, just little tiny fragile things. Indian. So I also wrote this on that roof. Oh. So now, from India, this is Jagannath Puri. I've had very nice experiences in Jagannath Puri, writing. It used to be a kind of place you could go and just write. Now it's being more and more built up with ISKCON's presence, which is good for preaching, but not good if you want to go and write Narada Bhakti Sutra and not get interrupted. But to speak of the value of Jagannath Puri as a pilgrimage place for the followers of Lord Chaitanya. So this was written there just in 1993. This is prose. And it's like a free writing style. Men are walking the beach in those drab, worn-out gumshoes they wear. I see a crow, the gray sky, the electric wires, the windmills that never move their modern blades. The windmills look like the gigantic props of a plane that can't fly. The mosquito net is saffron. I want to be left alone. No one is coming to bother me, but even the anticipation that this is not my house. I was staying in the house of a rich man, a devotee man from Calcutta. What's his name? Can't remember. Singhania. This is not my house. The awareness that I have no guards or secretaries at the door. Our host could come at any moment or send the floor cleaner, the bathroom cleaner, the sheet changer, or he could just come in and ask me to speak to someone. I would have to oblige. Just anticipating these possible interruptions makes it difficult for me to write freely. They will ask me, "What are you writing?" I'll tell them it's an old story about the time I met my guru when he went to America. We are printing it for the centennial. It's an adaptation of a poem by Richard Hugo, or it's all made up, or it's nothing you could understand, or I am writing of precious early hours. It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to fill the page. It doesn't have to be an orange because I can squeeze it and drink it. It can be a young coconut. It can be a monster munch, fun for kids, the corn candy advertised on a billboard. It can be a dented auto. It can be a disciple I thought rejected me and who feared I had rejected him. India is the land of Gurudev. Even the incense is called Gurudev incense. People want a guru, and other people want to play the role of being worshipped. I say, I don't want to cut the guru profile. I want to be friends with people and write my books. If they like it, great. Let them sell 12,000 copies of Japari Form Notebook in a few months in Russia. That doesn't mean I have to follow it up by being someone's advisor, marriage counselor, or business consultant. Oh, more from Jagannath Puri? No, Vrindavan. O Lord who danced and leaped at Ratha Yatra in Puri, O Lord Chaitanya who called out and cried to Krishna in the Gambira, we humble members of ISKCON wish to know you and serve you. O Lord Chaitanya, you embody Radha and her mood. You lay your feet on the pillow of Shankara Pandit. O Lord Chaitanya, please be kind to your devotees in ISKCON who chant Hare Krishna in every town and village. Please let us serve our Prabhupada. There's that sadhu who writes Radha on all the walls and trees in Vrindavan. Be like him, although it seems foolish. You go out with paint, bucket, and brush all day. Do something useful! A banker taunts him, and sadhus laugh. The music, if you can call it that, is demanding attention. The speech I wish to make is overwhelmed as their sound spills onto my page. Where is there room to think? Oh, Vrindavan, you are the most unusual place. Pouring out sentiments we can't make fun of because the names of Radha and Shyama are included and there is sincere feeling for them. We can at least not be silenced but add our own noise to the externally cacophonous combinations of bhajans pouring forth like smoke from campfires, like dust from cows' hooves, and bells clanging, seven different rhythms from 10 different directions. They rise up. If I take even one step back, it sounds like one big confusion. But it is praise of Radhe Shyam. This is also in Vrindavan, written on the porch of the room I was staying in the guest house. Sitting on a cot on the porch, the rain blows through the screen. I shut all the windows inside and the electricity is off. It has been raining hard now for over an hour. I see a white, black-faced monkey on the wall. I look through the mail but can't answer more than three letters. So much human pain, so many problems. Sitting here, I think of my parents. I was reminded of them because I read the letter of a woman who was divorced and remarried. She says parents want to give everything to their children. My parents rejected me on such flimsy grounds. I don't have the heart to grovel at their feet. They would only insult Srila Prabhupada and Krishna. If I want a relationship with them, I would have to listen to them. They haven't changed their views. They will make no compromise. And certainly they don't want to lose whatever little happiness and peace they have in their old age by confronting my rebellion and deviant values. Sitting here with the rain blowing on me. Another man writes that he doesn't feel Krishna's love. He's thinking of becoming a Christian. I think, here I am in Vrindavan, a conditioned soul, a product of my parents' upbringing and my rebellion from that. Am I in touch with love of God that makes me feel distant? Then I remember my connection to Srila Prabhupada. I sit here in the rain and look for my love. Who am I and where am I headed? Aside from the superstructure of Vedic values and theology, what is in my heart? Why am I so distant from everything, including myself? Will I have an awakening someday of a very basic kind? That seems to be what I'm looking for, something total. It should be Krishna conscious, but recognizable, basic, and human. The touch of Krishna and me being alive and surrendered to him and to my spiritual master. It seems that if someone writes poems or is a poet, he should mostly just write the poems and read the poems. And if you advocate the importance of poetry to the society at large or to the Krishna Conscious Society, it could be a deviation. You become a propagandist. But sometimes artists, poets, they do that, and it's sort of part of their conviction and dedication, and doesn't seem to be a distraction to their vocation. Maybe I'll say a few things, not so much that it may be needed by you, but it might be good for me to try it out in case I want to ever do it in a larger audience. Although it's mostly not my inclination. And I'm not so sure how strongly I feel about it. I mostly just feel very happy to be able to write like this and to have an audience and to make it as a very humble offering, not claiming, oh, this is important, Department of ISKCON, it should be heard, it's being neglected. That's how I mostly feel. But sometimes we feel we want to advocate what we're doing. I had an exchange about this with Kirtan Rasa. He gave me a letter, and I saw him this morning, and I said something about, I forget what I said. And then, so he said, speaking of the material society, that it's a soulless society, and they don't give art or poetry any importance. It's just a luxury for them. So then I thought, yes, he's speaking of the material society and their attitude towards poetry or art. They are a soulless society. But what about the society that does have self-realization? The advanced society of devotees, what's their attitude towards art and poetry? Of course, we have Vaishnava poets of the past, but we have Vaishnava expression in the present. Pranada sent me a letter by Prabhupada that was interesting. It was written to a temple president, and he said, so you've told me that you have one American poet there, Ted Burke. I don't know who Ted Burke was, either as a devotee or as a poet of any repute. Anyway, the temple president had written that this is some kind of a recognized poet, Ted Burke, and he's becoming a devotee. So Prabhupada was pleased. He said, I'm pleased to hear that the poet, Ted Burke, is living in the temple and becoming a devotee. He said, now that Krishna consciousness is spreading in your countries, we expect that there'll also be a Vaishnava poetry by Americans. So maybe this Ted Burke is the first one. So he was like recognizing that the difference between the great poets of the past and the present, but the welcoming of them. But it doesn't seem that it's much recognized or appreciated thing or any awareness of it in its real essence. There's sometimes an attitude that artists are in rebellion against society. That artists must be against establishment, and they can't be controlled by establishment, and that they're like in the front of the society, where society doesn't know their awareness, doesn't appreciate them, but they're actually they're heading the way that we all need to go and want to go, and eventually society will follow the poet or the artist. So maybe he's not supposed to be like, you know, the recognized leader. And if he becomes too recognized, then he can't do what he's supposed to do. But sometimes a great injustice or neglect happens in such a way that they can't even function. They become so depressed at nobody listening to them at all, and they're having a message that's so far ahead of the times, or so out of touch with the times, that nobody wants to hear them, or they in totalitarian countries, they get heavily suppressed for speaking that that truth of the individual. So, but the artists and those who themselves love these kind of expressions, they feel it's very important, and sometimes they speak out about the fact that it's so totally neglected. I had one statement that I read by a writer. It really struck me about the strength of his saying this. It reminded me of a stanza put in milder language by an American poet, William Carlos Williams, and that line goes something like, "People are dying for what is to be found in poetry, but they don't know it," or something like that, and they just ignore it. But they're actually dying for lack of what can be found there. So this writer, he puts this even stronger. The writer who wants to communicate with his fellow man and thereby establish communion with him has only to speak with sincerity and directness. He is not to think about trends, vogues, markets, acceptable ideas or unacceptable ideas. He has only to deliver himself naked and vulnerable. All that constricts and restricts him, his fellow reader, even though he may not be an artist, feels with equal despair and bewilderment. So in other words, when you go to read a book and you're really looking for something, well, maybe this book will give me something. Maybe this will be a real voice. And then it's not there, you're really let down. And even if you can't express it, it like, as the writer, he couldn't really express himself. That's his failure. And it really hurts society and the seekers especially. The world presses down on all alike. In short, they are suffering from the silent, shameful conspiracy, the more shameful since it is unacknowledged, which has bound them together as enemies of art and artists. They are suffering from the fact that art is not the primary moving force in their lives. They are suffering from the act, repeated daily, of keeping up the pretense that they can go their way, lead their lives without art. They never dream, or they behave as if they never realize, that the reason why they feel sterile, frustrated, and joyless is because art, and with it the artist, has been ruled out of their lives. For every artist who has been assassinated thus, unwittingly, thousands of ordinary citizens who might have known a normal, joyous life are condemned to lead a purgatorial existence as neurotics, psychotics, and schizophrenics. A little ornamentation to society. Let me read a little more. I'm running out of time. See what I want most to read. Well, here's something about Gita Nagari. When I was so long a resident here and identified with here, and then I realized I was going to have to move on. So some stanzas from a longer poem about that. Prabhupada. When I was writing of his life, Prabhupada's life, each evening seemed miraculous. As the tale unfolded, Prabhupada, spurned by a godbrother, going on alone to edit BTG. He had very little money, living in Vrindavan. My notes came together in this room, facing the window. The flowing creek is drab green. The bankside trees are upside down. Remember and farewell. Looking out from here, you visualize Sri Krishna in a poem called Dawn in Layers. 12 panes in the grid, the squirrel's playground, and a crude plank bench. And from here, I have waited for rarities, deer, fox, and a glimpse of their link to the Lord. In this cabin, convalescing for a year, silent backyard mantras, dragonflies and tiger lilies, cobwebs on my bike. But what if I get sick again? Where will I go to bed? Over the front door, the wrens keep building nests. When my friends visit, they laugh. It's like a hermitage. Canoe out the back door. It is sweet to close the curtains at night and to open them at dawn. goodbye, desk and lamp, goodbye, wood stove, pond and waterfalls, acorns on the roof, wind chimes, bench under the pine tree, outhouse, woodchuck, possum, the damp smell, special picture of Lord Chaitanya, diorama of Krishna Balaram, file cabinets and cold floor. Since I have been here, the trees have grown taller. I've seen Gitanagari babies grow. The pine boards in the cabin are darker, and some disciples have gone away. One or two more. It's sort of in the same mood. As I left the home in Gitanagari, I was invited to establish a home in Vrindavan. And this is called Deciding to be Renounced. We talked it out, and I decided not to own a house in Vrindavan. I'll visit with others at their places and stay at the guest house, lighter that way for me. Come and go without worrying about termites or deciding to kill mice. No one can say I own a big place in Vrindavan. Come and go with suitcases, holy pictures to place on desks, AA batteries, always a pen and notebook. You are more flexible than you may think you are. I hope this doesn't upset someone's plans. Hope I can live with it and not resent those who have and those who have not. This will shape your future. When you grow old and sick, you can lie down on someone else's bed. Tell stories of all places you visit. No one captures you. You are ready to move. Now make game plan. What kind of a book will you write for your 93 visit to Vrindavan? And if it gets too crowded in the mandir, where will you go? Get yourself thinking of what will happen, how you will be happy writing on any desk provided, seeing Srila Prabhupada in his samadhi every early morning, and Radhisham and all devotees. Don't see them as intrusions, but people. When you go, if you can, to Vrindavan. Now I'll read one that's more a preaching poem. To the author of, is the title of his poem, Pessimism in a Burger King in Minneapolis. I read a poem by Professor Hunt Hawkins, Pessimism in a Burger King. It was dreary. He sees restraint from killing as a sour philosophy that contemplates too much on evil, which the poet sees as inevitable and natural. Quote from him, "Fuzzy thoughts of Nebraska feedlots filter through my head. Suppose the contents of this bun were somebody's mother." But he really doesn't mean it. Just a passing thought. Lines for his latest poem. Quote, "How I wish we could all become angels without stomachs," he quips. "But who is asking us to do that? Lord Krishna allows us to fill the belly and enjoy nice tastes without hypocrisy and unnecessary slaughter." Hawkins quotes sour Schopenhauer, who compares the little joy of the eaters with the big unhappiness of the eaten. Then his hunger and ignorance get the better of him. He writes, "But heaven is so far away. Lifting my burger to my face, I decide to embrace the tragedy of life and take a bite." Dear Hawk, here's the irony that escaped you, the tragedy you forgot. You have to pay for killing. You have to take the karma. You and all the folks who led you to this conclusion that it's all right to eat flesh, that there is no next life, no justice, only something you play with and call tragedy of life. You missed the point and so candidly exposed yourself as guilty. I've come to remind you, your better thoughts were the right ones. I wish you had pursued them. Don't kill, it's not necessary. God gives us a system to offer him harmless food and devotion. It's called prasadam. Please accept this food for thought. Maybe I'll stop there for any questions or comments. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I never sent it to him or anything. I could do that. Yeah, I courted him a lot. Yeah, it's probably worth it. Fair enough.
You were speaking about Vargas in a different context of that.
Right, yeah.
The classification you're working with sounds more like on the level of self-realization rather than just like passion. Is there a different class of artists in that sense?
Yeah, right. The maker of the painting, like the rice painting on the floor, or the clay pots. Or the Murti, all these beautiful things. It's rather shocking that we hear the artist is a Shudra. But one thing, that means Shudras can reach perfection also. Rather than see it as an insult to the artist, and see how the Vedic culture, how even the Shudra is so glorious, can become glorious by making Murtis of Krishna, and they're so perfect craftsmen. that their works stay for centuries. But they're not the only artists. The kavis, the learned persons, the Brahmins, they're the only ones who can really write Krishna Leela poetry, and because they know that they can see through the shastras and everything. So I was using it more in that sense. But you'll come up against that in ISKCON if you try to talk of artists as something as important as I was saying it is. You'll be told that he's just a decorator, he's a Shudra. We don't need artists. We have a great need of managers for the temples and book distributors. One devotee told me, he read a book I published it was in Praise of the Mahajans, one of the first books. He said, when I read this book, he said, I thought that this is a sign of decadence in our society. He said, I've always thought of a poet. When a poet poets appear in society, it's a sign of decadence. The society is becoming decadent. That sounded to me like a Marxian idea that, you know, unless you've got a hammer and you're working in the office or something, then you're a decadent person. You're going against the aims of society as announced by the political leaders. Later he apologized, and he said, on behalf of all the Vaishnava poets, I apologize. But it was a candid remark by him, which probably others would hold, that it's just a waste of time when you should be doing something useful. So we're so pragmatic, so-called, about what needs to be done, that we don't understand that some of the real needs we have, and how an art like poetry can address it and can heal.